session of the Comics Arts Conference. New fun about Siegel and Schuster. And just so everybody knows, right,
do you mind if I record the panel and put it online?
There's a panel.
Do you mind if I record the panel and put it online? Okay.
Capturing copyright of comics creators. He's also going to be talking about Siegel and Schuster and the claims by Jack Kirby's days, who writes many Marvel characters. We've got programs for the conference. Co-chair Randy Young back there has them. I'm Peter Coogan, co-founder, co-chair of the Comics Arts Conference. Randy Young is co-chair and Kim Clancy, co-chair. And we do this as a way of bringing comics scholars and professionals together to talk about comics with the public. It's kind of a form of public intellectual work. We have many of the presentations and papers and so forth available on a DVD for a $2 donation that you can pick up at the end for me. And it also goes back about 8 years with presentations and papers, because we've been here since 92. And we also run panels at WonderCon. There's actually a call for participation on the back of the program. There's also a t-shirt that is available at the Comic-Con booth and the graffiti t-shirt booth. It's a nice red t-shirt. Randy's got it back there. And on the back it says, Academics Assemble. The Avengers.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm really glad. It's graffiti does an awesome job. And that goes to support Comic Con. So, are we right? We've got a great panel here, Gerard Jones.
We're good.
Right? Man of Tomorrow, history of comics. Brad Ricca, who organized this panel, organized a similar one last year, producer of Last Son. Lauren Agostino, a cover expert with the Siegel & Schuster lawsuit. Nikki Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson, the Major's grandmother, founder of DC Comics. And Mel Gordon, who's going to be talking about Funny Man, another Siegel & Schuster creation. Okay.
All right. Thank you. So are we on? How's my volume here? Good? Not? No? Okay. How about way back? Are you hearing me okay? All right. Well, I assume if you're in this room, you know who Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster were and their importance to the business. We're going to talk about various aspects of their careers and some ways in which they affected and were affected by some other people in the business. I guess especially Major Wheeler Nicholson, who's becoming this really interesting figure in comics history. And I want to start with Brad. Brad teaches at Case Western University in Cleveland and made a movie called Lost Son, a documentary about Jerry and Joe, and is working on a book in progress coming out from St. Martin's Press sometime. Do we have a date? No.
Unless you want to write it for me.
Yeah. On Siegel and Schuster, their lives, how they fit into the cultural continuum. So, why don't you present?
Okay, thanks, Jerry, and thanks, Pete, for having us once again to the greatest little conference in the world. Let me do this quickly. And I'll sort of leave some slides up longer, there we go, longer than others. I know it's hard sometimes to read comic slides, especially on a big screen, but that's part of why I wanted to do this. My paper today is kind of an excavation of a fairly extensive body of work that, for a variety of reasons, remains out of reach of most readers, scholars, and even collectors. And I'm talking about the early comics work of Siegel and Schuster, and this is found in New Fun, New Comics, More Fun Comics, New Adventure Comics, and Detective Comics. They all had those, really imaginative names. Everybody can hear me, right? Okay. My goal is here to kind of share and collect this, but also really, you write a paper, whether you write it in fourth grade about Norway, or whether you write it in, Comic-Con grade about Superman. And you don't really know what you wrote about until you're done, and it hit me this morning. Okay, this paper is about where do ideas come from, really. So that's what I'm going to talk about. And as I was finishing this paper last week, my... Okay. my hometown of Cleveland, Ohio, lost, all of us comics geeks lost Harvey Pekar. So this is dedicated to Harvey, who really, really hated superheroes. But he really loved the fact that he came from the town that Jerry and Joe did. So that's great. Okay. The story of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the two awkward teens, and this, of course, their famous high school yearbook photos, has become so chiseled into the source wall of comic book lore that it has become frustratingly immaculate. The facts are that Jerry, the nerdy kid with a nasally voice, was born in Cleveland, where he met Joe, a would-be artist and fitness buff, and they both bonded over weird pulp magazines. They started working on their school newspaper, put together their own science fiction fanzine, and we all kind of know this story, and eventually started doing comics, and then they did Superman, okay? But there's a big span of time in between that they worked on these other characters in magazines such as More Fun, cranking out stories like Dr. Occult, Radio Squad, Slam Bradley, and Spy. And I want to look at some of these characters. I don't want to say too much of how the characters were editorially came, where they came from, because we're going to see that later on in the panel. Some really cool stuff, I think. This is a great panel, by the way. So characters like, they worked on science fiction, and this is them, and it all leads to Superman. But here's New Fun, and Henri Duval, they're doing a Three Musketeers kind of ripoff, but really interesting stuff, and Dr. Occult, which is what I want to talk a little bit about now. So where did these ideas come from? And well, like I said, we'll hear about where the editorial ideas and decisions for these characters came for later. One of my arguments today is that a lot of the elements and people and things in these early comics came from Siegel and Shuster's own autobiography. Here's an example of Mrs. Amster, and she is named after Lois Amster, who was the pretty girl at Glenville High School who later claimed herself to be the inspiration for Lois Lane. And here she appears in this early comic. Even though she's married, she's wearing a provocative dress, ready to be rescued by the main character, here Dr. Occult. She is helpless to act and can only witness the horrific events from a subservient perspective. And there's lots of other names that appear, and that's Lois Amster. They drew her a literal different than she appeared in high school. Places, Chardon Cemetery, which appears in Dr. Occult, is a real cemetery right down the road. Places here, this is a Slam Bradley story where he fights some thugs on a skyscraper that's being constructed, and this is the Terminal Tower. And there's the swipe there. Federal men, they fight a maniacal knife-wielding maniac who seems to be drawn from the papers of Cleveland, the torso murderer. And there's a giant blimp explodes in the pages of Spy. And it, of course, is the Hindenburg. But there was also a local blimp that went down, too. And there's people, too. Anyone know who this might be in Federal Men?
Elena.
Close.
Looks like Edward G. Robinson.
Looks like anyone want to do an Edward G. Oh. Robinson? Yeah. It is Edward G. Robinson, 10 points to Nikki. And of course, FDR even appears in an early strip of Spy. And there's lots of schoolmates, and Jerry's brothers show up. Joe's brother, Frank, shows up about 7 times in these comics, so it's another way of getting themselves into it. If Siegel and Shuster seek to at least recreate some of their own real world through individualized autobiographical elements as opposed to just universally shared knowledge, in other words, like, what does a chair look like? We all know what a chair looks like. But do we know what Chardon Cemetery looks like? Do we know what the Terminal Tower looks like? The question is there a more substantial reason behind all this? Another common motif in these early Siegel and Shuster comics that might comment on that question is the use of doubling. where characters look at themselves in mirrors, wrestle seemingly identical twins, and frequently present themselves in disguise. This happens a ton in Slam Bradley. There's a lot of first pages of a Slam Bradley adventure where Slam is fighting someone who looks exactly like himself. And if anything has changed, he'll have, like, blonde hair. And this one, he's, you know, they're just kind of sparring. He isn't even a bad guy. There's a litany of Slam clones who spar one another. There's also transforming werewolves and vampires. Again, so you have looking in the mirror, and you can see yourself, which is really strange, but you can also see the werewolf. This is a Dr. Occult. I like Joe's werewolves. They look kind of like, I don't know, the Maltese dog. And there's also this level of differentiation between Slam and his sidekick, Shorty. In Siegel and Shuster, these pairings are either identical, like the sparring partners, or grossly different, like the werewolf and the man. Slam here is idealized, where Shorty looks like a cartoon. There's no middle ground, and kind of the sun is radiating behind Slam, and Shorty's just kind of looking at him. And Shorty kind of has that, you know, pre-Charlie Brown cartoon pattern baldness setting in. The more the differentiation, the more fantastic the other side becomes. Siegel and Shuster themselves use pseudonyms. They become Leaguer and Ruths. They try to double their personal experience in comics, but since that experience is fantasy, beating up werewolves, rescuing women, it becomes necessarily different. So again, this comes back to, is this real, autobiographical, or is it purely imaginative fiction? The comics themselves are a doubling of the real world. They provide an analogous fantasy, not completely fictional, correlated to the real one. And there's also a gender element to this, too, that I wanted to mention it without going into it too much, which is really kind of a cop-out. But there's a lot of these, you know, women in these early Siegel and Shuster who are both, you know, I can't be bothered by this, or I'm too good for this, but then they get kind of beat up by the policeman. Right? Or they're like Lois Amster, I must be rescued, but then they're the object of affection and desire. So there's something in the doubling going on there, and this, of course, made me think of our old pal, Craig Yeo, who was on this panel last year and kind of preached to everyone about Joe Shuster and his use of this. So I thought that would be interesting. So I wanted to look at one Slam story in particular. Starts out, he beats somebody up. Excuse me. But the interesting thing about this one is it takes place, the premise is they go back undercover to Glendale High School. Not Glenville, but Glendale. And here's a picture where, you know, they've been kind of rushed in. A detective, come with me, we're going to the principal. And there's the banner that says Glendale. And Slam gets put in front of a classroom. Nobody listens to him, of course, but the girls, of course, think he's cute. And even something as simple as the vice principal here, who's kind of telling, you know, children, this is Mr. Bradley, he's your new teacher. She's drawn from their real life, Miss Davies, who looks just like it. Joe appears in this story from the side, but if you think back to his yearbook photo, it's him with the glasses and the hair, listening to a lecture about physical fitness, which was his true passion at this time. The teacher is real, and Joe is real, and Joe is the attentive student here. And, of course, there's Miss Campbell, who's the one whose purses have been, you know, being snatched away, and, of course, she is based on a real teacher, Miss Campbell, too. And Shorty is not Slam, but Slam gets kind of made fun of in the classroom. Shorty can't really climb the gym ropes, but he ends up saving the day. You have two sides of it. You have Slam, who's kind of the brutish, strong man in the vein of Superman. But you have Shorty, who also can use his head, and he's a lot funnier, too. So they're kind of two sides of the same character. Sound familiar? I'm sort of arguing that Jerry is writing both sides to create one, the secret identity. It is his fantasy to get the fantasy girl, but his reality is more akin to Shorty's. My question is, if they put in all these references, and of course at the end of every Slam Bradley story, Slam gets the girl, Shorty never does. Well, he does here, but it's not the one he wants. And here's another one where Jerry actually puts himself into the narrative. He's a little kid, and he calls himself Jerry. And he's in this kind of, you know, Hal Roach kind of escapade where he has to rescue Steve Carson here, and Jerry puts a desperate plan into action. He's throwing rocks at the cops. And at the end, you know, everything's right with the world. He's given this congratulatory letter from the federal men, and his parents look on approvingly. But this is a complete fantasy. And the mother, of course, looks just like his mother, and his father is dead at this time, is again alive in the comics. So what's the point? I mean, why put something real in something that's so obviously fiction? And I think the point is right here. And this is the famous first page for Action Comics 1, right? And yeah, you've got Leaving Krypton, the babies lifting a chair, but the real point of this first page is that part at the end where they steal, you know, directly from a pulp, Science and Invention, Hugo Gernsback, and they say, well, look, if these crickets and ants can do it, why can't some guy from space? Okay, so it's grounding everything in truth. And this is what they learned working at the Torch, their style guide for being reporters. Jerry was the reporter at the Torch. The first thing it says is always tell the truth. Always find the truth, always report the truth. And I argue that they're putting some of themselves into these stories, these early, these crude, these rough, but these wonderful stories to try and get some element of truth to it. Because when it comes to Superman, I don't want to get too much into Superman, Superman is inextricably a narrative about the self, of a strong alien ideal who must hide behind glasses and ineptitude because he is afraid of his powers and success. His glasses function as Rousseau's famous spectacles of theater, acting to interpret the life outside the self. I would argue that Siegel and Shuster's early comics do the exact same things. They're versions of Clark Kent's glasses. And I have more, but I think I'll... And this goes to, you know, a huge domain. And there's other things I was going to talk about. But there is a lot written about autobiography in comics, and it of course is a large domain of modern comics. I think I have a slide here. This is another thing in Spy. It says, you can do all this good, you can save the world, you can be our greatest agent, but no one can ever know. And that last bit, you've got to sacrifice your personal life and all thoughts of marriage, right? This is kind of the fantasy of the teenager. You know, he's not going to get the girl, the nerdy teenager. He's not going to get the girl anyway, so why not create this fantasy around it where it remains the truth? But you look at people like Spiegelman and Picard, and again, there's this doubling here. You know, that isn't really who Harvey was, but it was kind of who he was. And same with Spiegelman creates the mouse entity, who works on a lot of different planes. But these are all ways of expressing the self, and I'm saying, and this was, you know, started a lot by Jerry's book, which certainly inspired me, to look at superhero creators and superhero comics not just as fiction, but as possible means to the biography of their creators. The standard superhero imperatives of truth, justice, and manly man strength, they're all present in these early comics, but there are also hidden truths of unrequited love and widely differing self-views. All we need to do is look past the glasses.
I want to inject a personal note, since Brad said I inspired him. Correct me if I've got the story wrong, but I believe Brad read my book, Men of Tomorrow, and was intrigued, but also said there are things that just aren't quite adding up. And wasn't this one of the impetuses for starting your research, to filling in my holes?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I think that's what history is. right? I read Jerry's book, and the first thing I said was, why had no one ever done this before? Because, I mean, I grew up in Cleveland. I knew the Siegel and Shuster story, but nobody touched it. It was, you know, it was like the Hope Diamond. It was in that, you know, little thing, and you can get a little close, but you can't go near. They came up with Superman, end of story, you know? I read your book, and they're doing all this stuff, and there's all this culture happening to them, too. And I realized two things. I totally agreed and said that, you know, there's no way. I mean, the story that I came away firmly disbelieving, and I disbelieve it now, is this whole story that, you know, Jerry Siegel woke up one night over the summer and had the idea for Superman. No way. I mean, they had bits and pieces of this for 10 years previous to it. So I'm trying to be like kind of the excavator going in, you know, kind of, well, I was going to make a Inception comment, but some of you may not have seen it yet. But I'm not answering your question.
No, that's
yeah.
I was just
but no, yeah, there was, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's things I'm going to, you know, build on from years. But that's history. And I think that's what makes it so intriguing to me, is because nobody ever gets it. You can't do it all, you know? Does that answer your question?
It does. And it's sort of my transition to Nikki Wheeler Nicholson, Aaron Brown, who Nikki entered my life because I, in that same book, I passed on some information I got about Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson. Didn't really have time or know how to do heavy research on him. And Nikki's aunt Diane heard about this and flipped out about the inaccuracies, the portrayal of the Major, which is kind of the standard comic book portrayal of the Major, but it hadn't really gotten to the, you know, sort of mainstream press until I wrote that. So then, I guess Nikki was considered the most sane of the
sane too much.
But through that, we've been talking a lot, and yeah. Nikki's now working on a book about her grandfather, which I think is going to be really interesting. A heavy, not just a family memory, but a heavily research-based book, which is going to say a lot about the birth of comics. What really happened, 1935, 36, 37, 38. So, including maybe where Superman came from. So do you want to start talking?
Okay. As Jerry said, I've become the family historian, basically. Every family has somebody, an aunt or somebody who collects all the family stories and the photographs and the archival material, and that ended up being me in a very strange and odd way, because I didn't really grow up with my grandfather. My parents were divorced when I was very young, and so unfortunately I never knew him. But my mother lived in the household with my grandparents, and when I came back into the family as an adult, over 30-something years ago, everybody was really concerned that I know the family history and the family stories. So I ended up being the person most interested and the person whom everybody gave the material to. I also have a background in, I'm a writer, and I have a background in editing and publishing. So it was kind of a natural sort of thing that occurred with me doing this. And I'm very familiar with research because this is something that I do every day in the work that I do. I'm used to the principles of research and what it means to have anecdotal evidence and what it means to have hard, cold facts. So essentially what I did is I took the family mythology, and then I started to build from that and do my research in various areas. And one of the things that struck me almost immediately was my husband was working for Doug Trumbull. I don't know if any of you all know him, but he's a very famous special effects director. And my husband was working for him, and evidently a lot of movie people like comics. Huh. Anyway, so after work, the guys would gather at a comic book store, and my husband picked up the book. I think it's The Complete Superman by Les Daniels. And in it, I don't know if any of you are familiar with that book, but in it there's a section about, can everybody hear me? Okay. There's a section in it that starts out about my grandfather. Well, the first thing I noticed is there wasn't even a photograph of him. There was just a drawing that came from, I think it's the March 1932 Argosy. I'm sorry, Argosy. And it's a drawing of him. You can see a little bit of his military costume. So they didn't even, D.C. did not even have a photograph of him. And in addition, the other disappointing thing to me in this section about him was there were some actual facts about his life that were true. But then Vin Sullivan commented on it. Well, he said this, and supposedly this. So it basically negated every single fact that was there. And I thought, well, this is not the person that I have come to know about, and the person that I think has been really marginalized in a lot of ways. So what I started doing is, first I got the information that was already out there about him, most of it very negative. Basically there's sort of three scenarios. He was a charlatan, he was a buffoon. I'm looking at you, Jerry Jones.
Good choice.
What was the other one? Buffoon, charlatan. Oh, and a liar. Okay, so let's talk about the buffoon aspect. Jerry, and I have to tell you, I love Jerry's book. I refer to it as the Bible. And
it's also wrong in a lot of areas.
There you go. So, one of the things, and I've said this to Jerry also, is that I love about his book is that as somebody who does research and works as an editor, one of the things I love about his book is that he took the history of comics and really put it into a historical context. And I think that's so important because clearly, whatever is happening in the world is going to be influencing people. It's not just, you know, lightning strikes kind of thing.
So give us your take on what really happened, as much as you can. What was his involvement with Siegel and Shuster?
Well, I think, what I want to say is that the pulp fiction is what's really important. First of all, you have to realize that that they were very aware of pulp fiction and really were very involved in reading it, were fans of it. And this is something that Brad has talked about as well. So I'm pretty sure that they actually knew who he was, because one of the things that a lot of people don't know is that my grandfather was one of the most prolific pulp fiction writers of his day. At this point, I have come up with over 107 novels, short stories, serials appearing in 164 magazines. That's at this point. I'm still finding stuff. And that also includes two pseudonyms, and I suspect there are more. That is a lot of material. That doesn't include all the comic book scripts from his early publishing in the 1920s, and then the whole new fun, more fun detective action comics in the 30s. This is a prolific writer. I'm not even talking about the four books of nonfiction and all the nonfiction articles, Harper's, Look. This man was a writer. He wrote every single day of his life. My mother said he used to just sit down and pound out something. My uncle says he wrote every single day. He was very disciplined. He got up every morning. The first thing he did, he made coffee, and he went in his office, wherever that might be, and he wrote for somewhere up to 3 to 4 hours a day. That's how he was able to turn out that enormous amount of material. This is not a dilettante. This is not a buffoon. The second thing, was he a liar? No. I have done a lot of research in military archives. I got to tell you, not only was he not a liar, but there's a lot of stuff that even people in my family had no idea about. So some of this material was Siegel and Shuster. Spy, very interesting, because my grandfather was in military intelligence. I have been looking at declassified military intelligence documents, and there's some really interesting stories in there. So I think this is the scenario that I'm assuming now. I'm not saying this is exactly what happened yet. I'm just saying this is a possible scenario that I'm looking into, is that they knew about him. They sent him the drawing, which everybody knows that story about, oh, you know, he was sent the drawing and they turned him down. I don't think that's exactly what happened, because what happened was they started working for him and they started doing a lot of comic book characters for him. And if you know his Pulp Fiction, then it's pretty obvious, and I do know his Pulp Fiction, it's pretty obvious where some of those ideas could easily have come from. And I will just read and quote from the 45th anniversary special. There's a letter that was printed in a DC comic book. It was the 45th anniversary special of Batman. It might have been Detective Comics, I'm not sure. It's a letter to Dick Giordano, and it's from Jerry Siegel. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read this little pertinent quote here. And Jerry says, on March 20th, 1936, Nicholson wrote to me, "We are now assembling our third magazine of the group, the financial arrangements for which were settled in a conference today. There will be from 4 to 6 pages of work in that for you." That third magazine turned out to be Detective Comics. In a letter dated May 13, 1936, Nicholson wrote in further reference to the book, quote, "We need some more work from you. We are getting out at least one new magazine in July and possibly two. The first one is definitely in the works. It will contain longer stories and fewer. From you and Schuster, we need 16 pages monthly. We want a detective hero called Slam Bradley. He is to be an amateur, called in by the police to help unravel difficult cases. He should combine both brains and brawn, be able to think quickly and reason cleverly, and able as well to slam bang his way out of a barroom brawl or mob attack. Take every opportunity to show him in a torn shirt with swelling biceps and powerful torso a la Flash Gordon. The pages are to run the same size as new comics, but to contain 8 panels a page instead of 6. And then it goes on from there. So I think that's pretty clear that he came up with the idea of Slam Bradley. And I would suspect that there is other material like this. But unfortunately, as we all know, with the lawsuits, that information that would be helpful to all of us who are interested in the history, a lot of it is not accessible right now. So anyway, I just like to end by saying that, as you can tell, I have a real passion for my grandfather, and it really has to do with his writing. For me, this is the essence of this man. This is where it begins and ends for me as a creative person. And if you think about Harry Donenfeld as this very flamboyant salesman who got out there and, you know, made DC happen in a lot of ways, and you think about Jack Liebowitz as this very strong, stern, intellectual, in some ways probably cold businessman, then I think that my grandfather is the heart and soul and had the vision for D.C. And that's the way I see him. So thanks.
Thank you. So yeah, it's a fun moment in comics history. These things that happened so long ago are suddenly becoming so much clearer, which is interesting how it goes. History then is sometimes found and written by academics, and sometimes found and written by members of important families, and sometimes history is shaped by somebody saying it to their paralegal in their law firm, "Lauren, would you mind throwing these things in the dumpster?" So why don't you first tell us how you came upon what you came upon, briefly, and then give us what you got. It's Lauren Agostino.
I found in 1947. I found 14 years ago a file in the trash that was labeled Superman, and it was the document. And it was the documents from the 1947 litigation trial of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. And I pretty much was asked to be on this panel, and it was a more fun panel. So I didn't have my document started in 1937, and they spanned to 1947. So I picked out two letters that I thought would be fun and you guys would like to see. And the first one is Jerry Siegel's original pitch to Action Comics 1, where he gives a base, he tries to make a little outline to see if any of these characters would work. He gives an he lines them all up for all the different areas that Action Comics was going to take a look in closer. Where he makes the adventure that Superman took its place, he proposed Bob Hazard, who was pretty much a la Slam Bradley. And he goes down to create a Western, a detective, and a sport, and gives a brief little description on how he thinks that they should be come out, how the backstory will be told, you know, to fit the Action Comics format. I'll give you a minute if you guys want to read it. And if you want me to go back, just let me know. Okay, and then I thought it would be fun was the actual letter that Vin Sullivan wrote. There you go, and Streak Marvel, which is a science fiction. Sorry, it's not cooperating. And here's the letter that's in very bad shape. But I try to put it up here as best I can. I don't think you'll be able to see a lot of it. This was the letter to Jerry Siegel from Vin Sullivan proposing Superman for Action Comics. He pretty much is asking Jerry to see if Joe would be able to pull out the artwork. Because out of all the artists that were submitted, he feels as if Joe could tell Jerry's story the best. And I thought this was pretty revealing because I think it kind of, the story on how Superman came to conception, you don't realize that Joe was actually doing 27 features before Superman ever came about. He was actually really busy. They didn't want to put any more on his plate. So, you know, it gives you just a little sneak peek into what was going on before Superman, because not a lot of people, they speculate, but there's not a lot, because Superman was what put them on the mark.
I just want to point out, this pretty flatly contradicts one of the classic stories, which is that Superman was sitting in the slush pile, and that Jerry and Joe did not know anything about Action Comics until they said, "We want to publish these, can you reformat them for the page?" Obviously, Jerry knew about Action Comics in the inception.
Yes. He did, and it's cool, though, if you look at his proposed, I mean, I guess a comic, oh, I'm sorry. I don't know if there's any characters that resemble these original pitches. I'm not really big into comics,
So, I mean, there could be, in that original Action Comics proposal, there could have been a character that came out of that. I really don't know what a little just changing of a name or a few features. Because he basically had an idea on how it should be, you know, for each, I guess, the area, adventure, science fiction.
Anything else in there?
No, that was it. I thought I only had 10 minutes.
it's so interesting how it just, these things we take for granted because they get passed on. We'll do Q&A after. Thanks. Are just not what we think they were. You know, you find some document that sort of unravels the whole story, and you start to think, well, what actually was the story? And I do really like, I was hoping you would tell the anecdote, that apparently a lawyer at this firm who had worked on the case.
There was a lawyer
before.
That was in the building. He died. He passed away. He was, I would say, in his late 90s. You know, I'm assuming from the file that he was the attorney for Jerry and Joe, which I'm from New York, from Westchester County, New York, and that's where the lawsuit took place back in 1947.
Key was that somebody had overloaded the dumpster, so you had to cut the bags apart.
No. The bags were too high. You couldn't put them over.
I like this. So thank you. So last, we'll hear from Mel Gordon, who teaches at UC Berkeley, has written a bunch of books about American, well, not just American, he did a book about Weimar Germany right there, about popular culture. And currently working, is this out? Is the Funny Man book out yet?
Yeah.
Okay, so
I'm the only one hawking a book, so.
You can hold it up.
So, yeah. It's Funny Man, it just came out officially a couple days ago, and it's the character that Jerry and Joe created after Superman. Normally, Jerry's just right that I write about European and American popular culture. This is my most successful of many books, many not successful. This is called Voluptuous Panic, The Erotic World of Weimar Berlin. That's proud to say in an eighth edition. So we'll hope that, or I'll hope that Funny Man that I wrote with Tom Andre does as well. It's also, it's a hybrid book. Which has its own origin story that I'll get to in a second, that, as I said, I'm a professor at Berkeley, and let me get to Breitbart there in the corner. I'll find it.
Lower right. No, I'm sorry, I'm misreading. Don't listen to me. There we go.
So, in the early 90s, just bring that up, perfect. In the early 90s, my good friend Richard Belzer's career was in the toilet. This is before Law and Order. And I decided to invite him up to Berkeley to do a live Showtime performance. And the time he's most funny is when he's being heckled. So I thought that since usually stand-up concerts don't have heckling, I'll put telephone booths in the aisles so people during the show can get up and, you know, heckle them and get their pictures on the stage. And we'll have phony ones like Belzer dressed as Hitler saying, "Belzer, I can tell a joke to you, Jew," you know, that kind of thing. And anyhow, I took Belzer to Bibliomania, a very good and still functioning a bookstore to look for conspiracy books. And while he was there for an hour, I saw the ashcan copy of Siegel and Shuster's Funny Man from 1947. I'd never heard of it, that they had created something else. And I looked at it and realized that this is Belzer's character, a kind of Jewish comedian from outer space or something. And we immediately brought it to Disney a lot, where there was some interest with the producers of Rocketeer that failed. And suddenly, we had to find out the rights. Jerry and Joe were still alive, and I tried to contact them, but of course, they wouldn't see anyone. And then I had a copyright lawyer in Washington find out about the rights to consign it to him. And it turns out Funny Man was never officially copyrighted. Yet again, if Superman wasn't the fiasco, that Funny Man was even lower. And I couldn't even get to them. And finally we put aside the project. And some decades later, I decided that I wanted to, in part after reading Men of Tomorrow, that I wanted to find my way into the history of comic books from a Jewish perspective, that astonishingly to me, Jerry Jones had done so well. But I wanted to add some other aspects to it. And the first, with Tom Andre, a Superman expert with Brad, that to look at, with recreation of some of the Funny Man material that didn't do well, but to look at it from certain Jewish points of view that had not been touched. One was the one of the origins or images of Superman that I think Brad has touched on, which I didn't know when I started, but it was my father's obsession. My father was exactly the same age as Siegel and Shuster. And his obsession, my father grew up in Poland and came to the U.S. and became famous in 1939 for inventing the word supermarket, according to the Grocers Union, and was obsessed with Superman comic books. But he was also obsessed with this other thing into his entire life, this Jewish strongman, Zsa Zsa Breitbart. And this is what I want to show quickly, that it's a connection that is very appealing to me because Breitbart, who started out in Warsaw, as we'll see, and traveled to Central Europe, and I wrote about him in certain ways, that Invincible was the phony story about him that Herzog totally ruined. I had to write the New York Times to explain that Zsa Zsa Breitbart couldn't have fought Hitler since he died in 1925 and never saw a Nazi. And that was in the New York Times editorial page the day he died. But Breitbart was an immense figure in Jewish life among Jewish boys in the early 20s into the middle 20s. And I'll quickly do a PowerPoint on this and then go to another topic. Here's Breitbart, despite what people have said, that Breitbart came from a criminal family in Łódź, was probably gay, and so all the stories about Breitbart, my father translated his autobiography from the Yiddish. Breitbart was this immense folkloric subject, and maybe the most important Jew in the entire 20s, before the rise of trade unionism in America and political Zionism in Europe in the 30s, that Breitbart was the single most new image of this primitive invention of the new Jew. The Jew that was handsome, was outside European culture, and very muscular, and called himself Superman. Here he is in one of his booklets, Breitbart featured by leading papers of America as the Superman of the Ages. Superman is everywhere that the word Breitbart is. And as I said, he played in Toronto and extensively in Cleveland when Siegel and Shuster were 9 years old. Here he is starting out as a Yiddish postcard and Breitbart doing all these superhuman activities. He tried to bill himself as the reincarnation of Samson or Bar Kokhba, one of the Jewish generals that fought the Romans, or as this idea of the Jewish gladiator outside this sophisticated and evil European culture. And here we have all kinds of Superman-like images everywhere. Halting a train, stop, no further, and wearing a cape. And he looked quite different from the strongman of the time, of the early 20s, who usually had mustaches and were bulky, that Breitbart looked like Valentino. He had a curl in his hair, by the way. And these are some of the many posters. There's dozens of these everywhere of Breitbart doing things. Some of the stuff he did was phony, which I've written about. One was biting through chains, which is impossible to do even with iron teeth. What he did was that he would take cattle chains, he'd break them in his hand as he put them into his mouth. It's very good. And there he is. Yeah, he was actually, Ripley's, of course, thought he was the strongest man in the world. Here he is. But what's unusual is the look and presentation himself. In Europe, he was a kind of ideal of Zionism, which will change. And here he is in his big moment in 1923, which I've written about, when the Jews of Europe, the Jews of Vienna had split between assimilationists and Zionists. And Breitbart, of course, represented the Zionist. And he would do things a la Clark Kent, or as we'll see with Funny Man. He did things that Jewish audiences would definitely read as Jewish, that no one else would see. For instance, he would wrap iron bars around his arm like they were tefillin or the phylacteries that Jews would recognize in a second, eight loops. Or he would break bars into the shape of chalets. Of the images that you'd see on a challah that Jews would understand instantly. So there was a lot of these references that Jewish audiences read differently than non-Jewish audiences. Here he is biting through bars, and he had his own Puccini-like theme, and he had gladiators, and there's even movies of Breitbart that we don't have time to see today, but I'm glad to send to anyone. There's quite a few. All five of the newsreel companies, when Breitbart came to America, made special movies that are fantastic of his work in his entrances. One of the books I wrote about was about Hitler's Jewish clairvoyant, Erich Jan Hanussen, whom we see here with a Jewish prostitute, Martha Farah, in Vienna. Hanussen was a hypnotist or clairvoyant in 1923 on Breitbart's stage, but he realized that the audiences in Vienna were looking for Wundermänner, you know, wonder men. So Breitbart decided, Hanussen decided that he could challenge Breitbart on the stage by saying he can take the lowest girl in Vienna, in this case a Jewish prostitute, and hypnotize her into being stronger than him, which this is what the poster shows. Hanussen hypnotizing Farah, who appears naked, she never was, and knocking out Breitbart, and here she's biting through the chains. Of course, both Breitbart and Hanussen understand something called sex appeal. That here Breitbart on top in the cartoon is, you know, a great appeal to the Viennese women, and the opposite is true for Martha Farah. Breitbart takes Hanussen to court. He makes a movie. There's all kinds of problems. Max Brod and Kafka become involved with him in Prague and so forth. And Breitbart then comes to America in the summer of 23, and we see something new. He's never described as a Jew again, except to Jewish audiences in Yiddish. That Breitbart the Mighty Man, Breitbart is a youthful Pole, derived from the best blood of Poland, and so forth. So we have this idea in America, it could be economically and commercially disadvantaged to advertise yourself as a Jew. It could be dangerous. And here we have Breitbart using new technologies. He's balancing his motorcyclist and the ramp, and this is what the movies show. And here he is. I found a picture in Cleveland, where this huge bar is bent over his head, again, not so far from where the Siegel family grew up. And even more, Breitbart, by the way, was sent back to Europe, that one of the Jewish heads of the AMA, which had just been founded, was to prevent German medicine from coming to America, things like psychoanalysis and other things that no one believes in. And Breitbart had his own medicine, saying, boys and girls of America, there's two things you should avoid, milk and meat. So the AMA had him deported immediately because of that. He went back to Germany. He died very much like Houdini died, through an accident of a nail was pounded into his leg. It got gangrene. His legs were amputated. But somehow, the Breitbart commercial world continued without him. Here's Breitbart's physical a culture theater for health, strength, and muscle. And if you look on top of the letter, there's two things of importance to us. It says, Zygmunt Breitbart, the Superman of the Ages, and above it is his cable address, Superman, New York. And this went on for many years and becomes the inspiration for Charles Atlas and other people like that of this Breitbart muscle course, which I've collected, and they're fantastic and very interesting courses with how to build up different parts of the body and so forth. Again, something that both Siegel and Schuster were interested in later. So I just wanted to bring this to you. I think I've run out of time. So I'm going to go and just talk about one of the other things in Funny Man. The story of Funny Man is which Tom and I have tried to put into two contexts. One, of course, is the biographical and historical context that it just, in the post-war era, it was hard to figure out where the superhero was going. And Funny Man was one way into it. Well, Siegel and Schuster were obsessed with humor. Siegel had tried to get a book published called How to Be Funny, with 10 lessons that we went through. There's only one copy. Brad, do you have that?
No.
Yeah, we're all looking for it. And it'll probably show up on eBay. And one of the things that I wrote about, finally, was something brand new, which is what I like to do, to show the story of Jews and comedy and humor and how it applies to Siegel and Schuster. In just a few words, what I tried to do is to prove all the academics totally wrong. The normal explanations of the Jewish obsession with humor is that the Jews are funny because they've suffered. Well, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of, because it's so many people have suffered, like Tibetans, Amazonians, Biafrans, Rwandans, Koreans, Armenians, and on. None of those people are universally known for humor. And among the most difficult historical periods, which, of course, there are many among the Jews, none of these are great subjects of comedy. The second idea, the Jews have always been funny, which doesn't make any sense, because in the Bible, there's just two words for laughter. One is when Sarah hears her 90-year-old husband, Abraham, is going to impregnate her, so she laughs. You know, that's one of the two instances. And God condemns the Jews for being a stiff-necked people. And then there's also a theory that the Jews are funny because they've always been outsiders in their diaspora. I bring up a completely different theory, how all of Jewish humor began in one day. There was no such thing as any particular kind of Jewish humor till 1661. And this is that the Jews shared exactly the same humor of all the host countries. And in 1661, at the end of a series of pogroms, the Chmielnitsky massacres that were Holocaust-like for the Jews in Eastern Europe, the rabbis, and I'll do this in one sentence, the rabbis, the four consuls, got together and decided there's only three possibilities why the Jews are suffering so much. Either God doesn't really care about the Jews, that he lied when he said he'd take care of them to the end of time. Two, the Jews have done something wrong, or the Kabbalistic idea that God is weak and the Jews have to help God. So they took the second idea, and they banned all merrymaking and all professional comedians from Jewish life in Eastern Europe, in Yiddish-speaking Europe, except for one class, which is the least popular, called the Batchonim, the Botkin. The Botkin was the insult artist, and the insults were scatological and super aggressive, and this became, up until the 20th century, the only kind of professional humor the Jews had, and I put many examples of Botkin humor and how humor becomes the highest construct for the Jews, how it happened, why Woody Allen and Joan Rivers are marriageable material, good marriageable material, but only among Jews, because how important humor is in Jewish life. And finally, I think I started out with, this is brought up in the Kenneth Starr report, because after Monica Lewinsky and and Bill Clinton had oral sex, that Bill Clinton, of course, got leaves of grass for Monica Lewinsky to show what a stand-up guy he was, but she got him a Jewish joke book called Oy Vey, and how this is analyzed in the Kenneth Starr Report. And I try to look at it from a completely different point of view of why Siegel and Shuster wanted to create Funny Man, how important it was to bring this finally to the surface, this obsession with humor. Okay.
Great, thank you. Yeah. And just we're in a whole other discussion, but worth remembering to what an extent Superman also was kind of a slapstick character often.
Right. Exactly, yeah.
So it opens the Q&A. What I'd like to do, I know there's going to be some questions that are very much about comic history minutiae, but I'd also, you know, if there's anything in general, would like to address that. Who's got something to say or ask? I think Mike was the first to ask.
I just wanted to clear up one thing on one of the slides that Laura had shown. Mm-hmm. That letter from Ben Sullivan didn't have a year on it, but that was 1938, was it not?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to be sure.
David,
yeah. Nice seeing you. Ben Sullivan was my friend. I first met him back in 1992. And we had some terrific conversation of the past. Ben Sullivan liked Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster very much. Funny Man became a reality because through Magazine Enterprise, they were desperate for work. Vince gave them a job to help them out. That's how Funny Man came to be.
Right.
It was essential. I met Joe Shuster back in 1982. Lovely man. I had the privilege of going out to dinner with him 3 times. Spent a lot of time talking to him. Met Jerry Siegel back in 1985. Very difficult man to talk to. The last job he did for DC was in 1966, and that was a job to even get out of him to say that to me. Joe was a very, they were very trusting people. Vince Sullivan told me a story back in 1938 with Superman. Vince Sullivan advised Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster before going in to sign the deal with Jack Leibowson in Donsville. Vince had a brother who was a lawyer. He wanted them to use, Vince wanted him to give them, use that service to protect them. But they were so trusting. John Donsville and Leibowitz said, we're going to take good care of you. And they turned it down. Vince did care about Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. It's a pleasure to see you here. I talked to you back in 1992. I brought together Vince Sullivan, Fred Garnier, and Craig Flessel together because my job over the years was to track down artists, bring them here to San Diego Con. I spent too many years at it, tracking down people. All three of them talked about the major.
Right.
All of them had the deepest respect for your grandfather.
Yes.
The problem was the 2-year period with your grandfather was the survival of the company. Too much pressure. Vince, he did everything like your grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote, draw. It was just tremendous pressure during the early days to survive. They follow Max Gaines' publication, but they were the first to bring all new stories to the comic book field. And that's why your grandfather could not, he had to let it go. He just, Craig would hang around those offices just trying to make sure he got paid.
One thing I want to say.
And that's the real truth.
Yeah,
so when they left, when they sold it, that's when Donsville and Leibowitz take over. And
it's an interesting, but one of the things that Craig did, it's so interesting doing this. Work, this historical work, because there are so many people who, good people, well-intentioned people, have different memories of what happened. It's so interesting. We'll try to make it match when possible, and then try to find some hard information too. I ended up,
typically you're supposed to see as the bad guy in these stories. And so, yeah, I'm glad you. Thank you for getting people like
but
that.
Look, but let's point out this. May I point this?
One last thing. Yeah.
One quick thing. For 5 years, Vince Sullivan was making all the decisions, pretty much. He was the head editor. He made those decisions. He was the driving force. We should be extremely grateful for Vince. If it wasn't for him, he's the one responsible for hiring Bob Kane, the creator of Batman, Sheldon Moldoff. The whole league of people was Vince, who played the most important role.
Important people remember.
And he was a supporter of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.
Thank you, David.
It's a small legend. Yeah,
thank you. Question back there.
Yeah, this is in relation to the Breitbart. It's a little bit off topic.
Okay, yeah.
I'm interested. I never knew about this character, but it's in relationship to the whole Third Reich's fascination. Was this a general thing? Because it's interesting that the rancor against the Jews and the idea of some kind of Superman, and one of the most famous ones being Jewish. Was Hitler aware of this? I mean, I guess I can't say that, but was there any conversation there about...
Well, this is so early that, you know, Breitbart was this phenomenon in circuses all over Central Europe, in Eastern Europe. But then he disappeared. You know, he died in 25, and... Breitbart set up all these Zionist clubs in Vienna and Berlin, and you know Jews should be these great muscular primitives and go back to Palestine. And so, in some ways, it was a deflection or even parallel what was going on among Gentile youth in Germany of this idea of building your body and being outdoors and get back to the land. So it was a parallel idea that was going all through Europe.
There was no real correlation, more like this rather than a cause and effect.
After the war, that again, this is so far afield, but after the war, essentially what happens that there's a collapse of belief systems each country in a different way in Europe and even in America. And so people are looking for what to supplant the old beliefs were. And one of those ideas is magic, one is health, and so forth. And all these things begin to grow very quickly because of the technologies.
One of the really common themes in American culture and European culture in the first 30 of the 20th century was this idea of the physical marvel, the sort of moving away from the idea that our future will belong to the intellectually evolved, but also to the physically evolved and self-developed. I think to some extent the Nazis were tapping into that rather than generating, because you had Bernard McFadden over here, Sandow and so forth. In there. So it's a I think this, both Hitler and Siegel and Schuster were pulling from a similar thread of fantasy about perfectibility, about the future of humanity. Yes?
Despite the gravel, I think your book is magnificent.
Thank you. That's the only reason I host this panel, is to manipulate people into saying that.
How many issues of that fancy science fiction did Siegel and Schuster do before?
This is one of those Ask Brad or Check
Five.
Thank you.
I think, unless
they... Is that available information for scholars? Or
that stuff's hard to find. No, go ahead. You know more.
I know one person who has every one of them. And there's a Kevin Bacon kind of thing going on with someone on this panel. And I've kind of begged him, let's publish it, get it out to... whatever. But... No, there's a couple that are, though. Florida, is the University of Florida, they have the one with Reign of the Superman on it. It's scanned in, and you can look at it for free, and it's awesome. So if you're interested in it, go look at it, because it's really cool to see how it's changed. And I like looking at all the other stories they did, too, that aren't just the Superman ones. But hopefully someday, they come up for auction every once in a while. Somebody just, all five of them came up maybe 5-6 years ago, and somebody bought them. But someday, hopefully they will. I mean, a lot of this stuff gets, disappears into the collector's world, But maybe someday it'll come back to the reader's world. I don't know.
Thank you.
I'm really not bitter. I just like to read this stuff like you do. It sounds like you want to read it. Read it too.
There's historical stuff there. It speaks of sources.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And there's that missing number two that supposedly shows that Jerry Siegel knew of Philip Wiley's Gladiator, but nobody seems to go either way with that one. So
I don't think there's any question about that.
It sure looks like it. But yeah, then I have to say, well, do I know?
There's a lawsuit about that, right?
Don't say it, you might get sued right now.
Take another question from the back.
Mickey, my visual image of your grandfather of that legacy photo is Will Eisner's drawing of him in The Dreamer. I don't know if you've seen that graphic novel, and he depicts him as something of a dandy, you know, Ray right. Cat style. I mean, so was he a snappy dresser, and what do you think of Eisner's portrayal of him? It kind of feeds into the whole misconception you're talking about.
It's, you know, like everything, there's a grain of truth in it. You know, he was a military man. He started his career as a military man. And he was really big on the way one should look and what a gentleman is. He wrote a book in 1922 on the cavalry and people like, Prescott, who wrote a book much later about the military, quoted him because it was a whole thing about what a gentleman is and how a gentleman should look. And so he in a lot of his Pulp Fiction, the hero is always dressed very nicely and very sharply. His uniform is, and the bad guy is always sloppy. And that was obviously kind of important. My grandparents lived in Europe in 1927, 28, 29, and 30. And my grandmother was European, and my grandfather dressed very nicely, had money for very nice clothes, that kind of thing. And when they got back to the United States, they were dead broke. And so he had all these really nice, expensive clothes, but over time, they were very worn. And so essentially, he was a natty dresser, but it was older clothes. And the whole hat thing, the beaver hat thing, there's a great picture of him that I think, if any of you see the documentary tonight, I think Sean and Matt are using this wonderful photograph of him that my Swedish cousin Finn Andrean took, and he has on a fedora, and he wore a fedora all the time. And my other granddaddy used to wear those hats. A lot of men in the 40s used to wear them. And so I think that's where the whole beaver hat thing came about.
Maybe we can talk about this later, but for some reason, the thing that most seems to annoy the Wheeler Nicholsons is that beaver hat. I got it from Ben Sullivan. Ben thought the major wore a beaver hat, and I put it in print.
Well, in all fairness, my cousin Chris, who is a stickler for, so, in fairness to Vince, Chris said that often those fedoras were actually made of brushed beaver. So somehow it got, I guess, from the brushed beaver to some Russian beaver hat.
Is it a material versus a shield?
Yes.
I think it's a material one. Right. But all your Uncle Doug said he also wore hats.
Yeah, in the summer. Yes.
Yes, they get the hat nailed down.
Right.
Long against fedora.
Yes.
Yes, it's fascinating to me to hear about the motivations that Siegel and Shuster might have had, what appealed to them in terms of development of Superman character. And, you know, one thing, I was just thinking along with you with the Jewish font. If you think back to Joshua, and then, of course, the Samson, and right up to the Maccabees. And the revolt against Rome,
all of that, even in Jewish life, it was kind of new, that a lot of it had been stimulated by the novel Ben-Hur. that Jews from German speaking world and Mediterranean world had already been in the U.S. and California, but during the Great Migration of Yiddish speakers beginning in the 1880s, that they seemed totally peculiar and sounded peculiar and acted peculiar, and the one thing that made Americans interested in them was the novel Ben-Hur, that these were the same people who were back in Judea, and also the Jews began to think of that too. So at the same time, people were looking at Jews as this ancient people in a very peculiar way in Roman times mostly. The Jews were beginning to rethink themselves, and partly because of Zionism that was growing at the turn of the century, but also for other reasons. So you have all of this in Siegel and Schuster's minds, like my father's, of this new image of what, you know, this new idea of what the Bible really looks like and how they fit into it. Yeah, I'll just say one thing because everyone's going to, you know, comment on this, I think, and I'll try to be quick, that this is what got me excited to write about this. Several writers had made this connection between Superman and Krypton was like the Jews in Eastern Europe, that they were sort of normal and they became superhuman when they came to North America. And the thing that followed them, Kryptonite, was anti-Semitism from Europe that, you know, prevented them from attaining their powers, and also this idea of to conceal themselves as Clark Kent, this kind of Jewish-looking persona. So you, instead of two characters of Superman and Clark Kent, you actually have three. You have Superman and Krypton, Superman in America, like the Jews, and you have Clark Kent. And all of this was, and lots of scholars have written about it, I think...
Danny Finkeroth,
to me it was quite appealing because it sort of fit in the world that I had seen. Brad?
I defer to you on this and highly recommend Funny Man, especially because of your discussion of humor, which I've how Jewish humor evolved, which I've never read like that, but. What I find is those, because you get that too. I mean, we have a Jewish museum in Cleveland, and they have a nice little Superman exhibit, and it's, you know, Superman's Moses, right? But from what I've, you know, pieced together, and again, you never know the whole story, was that Jerry and Joe really, more than anything, rebelled against their parents' Jewish beliefs. That they, you know, didn't... celebrate the holidays as much that they... Jerry's second published story is a Christmas story in the Yuletide spirit. So I don't know. I think there's... Absolutely, there's the allegory of coming from the old world, you know, as being kind of launched through space in this boat or this ship, assuming another identity. That's absolutely all there, but tying it to specific scripture, I think they never said it, and I don't think I see it either.
This will be the end of it.
Good wrap, yeah. Just a little note on that is it's also worth remembering that at that time the Jews, the children of the Eastern European Jewish immigrants were sort of dominating American popular culture in virtually every field. So there was something about them and their worldview, especially secular Jews, that was just speaking to American movies, popular song, beginning of comedy, jazz to an extent. So that's a big subject.
Yeah, I'll just say it in one sentence, that in the Jews, like my father's world, and indirectly Siegel and Schuster, there wasn't a great division between high culture and low culture in Eastern Europe. That, you know, you didn't have Shakespeare and Penny Dreadfuls. That all of that world of high and low culture was greatly, you know, closely related. So So therefore, popular culture didn't seem as alien, as offensive, and is far away as it would in Anglo-Saxon world.
Yeah. And that, I think, is sort of where we've gotten to in America. We have academics talking about the birth of Superman. that was the beginning of something that's universal.
That was the way the first class on comics started, the birth of Superman, the connection to Moses. It's the story Michael Uslan tells. Okay, so that's the end of this panel. We'll be back in 10 minutes with Recapturing Copyright for Comics Creators. We're talking about the DVD from this year going back.